waiting for people to get settled and to come in. And before I kind of start formally, what I'd like to ask you all is about your background in meditation. Is how many of you are new to meditation? This is really new. What? Well, I'm still new too, so. how many of you have are new to this particular form of meditation, to Vipassana meditation? Who didn't raise your hands last time? You know, done Zen or other things like that. And so what are some of the other meditation practices people have done? I think Zen, I know. What else? Yes, please. TM. That's how I got started, was with TM. Anybody else? Kind of nice to know the background of people here. And, okay. So, let me welcome you then to our 5-week intro class in mindfulness meditation. And say a few words about myself. My name is Gil Fronsdal, and I'm the teacher here at IMC, the Insight Meditation Center. And I've been teaching for this group for 12 years now, since 1990. And originally we were in Palo Alto when I joined the group. And I'd come to that area in order to work at Stanford, and I got to do my graduate work in Buddhist studies. And the group slowly grew until finally we come here. The my background in meditation is that I was a Zen practitioner for many, many years. I was ordained as a Zen priest, Zen monk, and spent time about 3 years in the Tassajara Zen Center Monastery, and also at Green Gulch. Some of you might have been there, and San Francisco Zen Center, and also a year in the monasteries in Japan. And then I also spent a fair amount of time in Southeast Asia, including a small period of time as a Buddhist monk in that particular Buddhist tradition in Southeast Asia, Asian tradition. And it was in Southeast Asian tradition of Thailand and Burma where I was introduced to the meditation practice I'll be teaching you. That's where it's coming from, is those countries. And when I came back to this country, after being in Asia for many years, then I continued both my interest in Zen and Vipassana in mindfulness meditation, and eventually became authorized to be a teacher in both traditions. So what all that means is that I have a long background in meditation. I have a great interest in it. I find tremendous value in the meditation paths and meditation practices. And I find it really wonderful for me to have the opportunity to share a little bit of what I've learned and but hopefully also share my inspiration, the value I get from the mindfulness practice. And it's a fortunate thing to be able to share what you love with other people. So I hope that all of you find some value in the things we'll teach in these 5 weeks. So a few kind of overview things. I will be teaching basic instructions in mindfulness meditation. And the way that those instructions have evolved here in the West is that we give them sequentially over time. So you have a time to kind of work with one particular set of instructions, kind of as a foundation. And then using that as a foundation, then you get to work on a different set of instructions. And basically you can think of it kind of as 5 weeks of supporting each other, one after the other. The first, today we'll talk about the basic aspects of meditation, posture for meditation, and working with the breath. The breath being very central to the meditative enterprise in our tradition. And then next week we'll talk about including the body, being embodied, the importance of being in your body as part of the meditation practice itself, and how being in the body supports meditation practice. The following week we'll talk about mindfulness of emotions and how emotions can be included as part of the field of attention, of awareness, part of the meditation itself. But it's a lot easier to learn how to be mindful of emotions if you've already had some practice and instructions in learning how to be mindful of the body. And it's a lot easier to be mindful of the body if you've had some instructions being mindful of breath. Then the fourth week, we'll talk about mindfulness of thoughts, of the mind, of thinking. And it's a lot easier, again, to be aware of that if you've already learned how to be mindful of your body and mindful of your emotions. And then the last week, kind of based on everything we've done so far, we'll talk various things, but we'll talk a little bit about the application of this practice into daily life. And one of the things that I tend to do sometimes when I do this intro class is that I slide back and forth between talking about mindfulness as a meditation practice and talking about it as something you do in daily life. And it might be a little bit confusing, so I'll warn you ahead of time. What is he talking about now? In my mind, there's no sharp line between being mindful in meditation and being mindful in daily life. And in fact, in order for the full path to open up, the full benefits of mindfulness to open up, mindfulness is something you'd apply in all aspects of your life. Eating, having conversations, working, whatever you're doing. And it's not something you'd limit just to the time that you're meditating. Meditation, as many of you know, is recognized as being very helpful for people. It has a lot of medical benefits. It's good for your body. It's good for your mind. It's good for your heart. People who are stressed find great benefit in unstressing and relieving stress. The more concentrated and stiller the mind gets, the more healing qualities that tend to come from the meditation. I've been quite in awe sometimes in deep meditation, what it feels like, almost like a healing force kind of coursing through the body. I don't have any empirical evidence to know that I was being healed by anything, but it was certainly very powerful to have this very strong feeling of unification, of harmony, of wholeness coursing through my body. And the sense was it was very healing. And I know some people come to this meditation practice for that, those purposes, for the physical benefits you get, for, you know, to relax a stressed heart and prevent heart attack for some people, and to reduce stress in other parts of our life. And there's a lot of benefits that can come that way. In its Buddhist context, which is the original place this came from, this practice is meant to do a lot more than simply help create physical or mental health in some simple, ordinary way. The mindfulness practice is meant to help us see very deeply, much more deeply than you can, kind of surface consciousness, the kind of consciousness, the kind of awareness you go around with in normal life, but to help you get the mind concentrated and still enough and sharp enough so it can really see the tremendous subtlety of how your psyche works, what's going on there, so that you can begin taking responsibility for how your psyche works. The things that you pick up, the things you engage in, the channels and directions that your thoughts go, the channel and directions that your emotions go, the things that you hold on to, things you resist to, the judgments, the ideas that you believe in, the cognitive ideas. To really see these tremendous clarity is very liberating. And to do that right down to kind of, in the traditional Buddhist path, right down to the very core of our being. And we can get down to the core of our being with the mindfulness. There's the opportunity and there's for what Buddhists call liberation. A radical, transformative experience in which some of the very most, the Buddhist terminology we call the latent tendencies towards clinging, resistance, hate, greed, confusion are uprooted. I don't know how, for what purpose any of you will adopt the practice. You don't have to do it. You don't have to adopt it for its Buddhist purposes. You can be very happy if you use it just for basic stress reduction. But you should also keep in mind that the mindfulness practice is said often enough to be the heart of Buddhist meditation. The heart of Buddhism is found in the mindfulness practice itself. The Buddha gave more instructions on practicing mindfulness than any other practice in all his teachings. And I hope that as the 5 weeks go along, you get some inkling of idea of how this practice can be very transformative, not just simply a matter of accommodating or coping better with life, but actually help transform you in some deep way in your psyche. So mindfulness is kind of the name of the game for this practice. So what is mindfulness? And mindfulness that we teach has two important qualities to it. One is it's the quality of recognizing clearly what your experience is in the present moment. To be present for your present moment experience. And the second important quality is learning how not to interfere with that experience, interfere with what you're aware of, by judgments, criticizing that's bad, that's good, holding on to it, saying, this is great, I never had so much rapture in my life, and I'm going to hold on to it. People get really brittle holding on to whatever joy or calm they have in meditation. It's just a setup for feeling terrible. Or they interfere by saying, I hate this. This is terrible. And I'm going to run away. I'm going to push it away. I'm going to deny it. I'm going to do something unhealthy towards it. The movements of being for or against our experience is not what mindfulness is. It's rather, it's clearly recognizing what our experience is and learning how not to interfere with it. Learning how not to get entangled with it. And sometimes in our tradition, we express this with the idea of being accepting of the experience. Now, being accepting of the experience is a little bit complex because people say, does that mean it's supposed to condone it? They're supposed to condone things, but it's a tremendously useful art to learn how to let some experience be without acting on it compulsively, addictively, reactively. And so it's a training of learning how to see clearly what's there and then training ourselves. Some people like to talk about having a gap between the stimulus and the response. If there's no gap, then the tendency is it's habitual, sometimes unhealthy reactivity that takes over. So some ability to let things be, to not interfere, not pick things up, not act on the arising of something. So, for example, you might get angry. So mindfulness would be clearly recognizing your angry, to be present for your anger, which is no small thing. And then it's also learning how not to interfere with your anger or get entangled with it, just leaving it alone and allowing it to be as it is. A kind of acceptance of it. But not the kind of acceptance that says, oh, great, I'm accepting my anger and I'm going to punch that guy out. You know, I'm going to, you know, yell at my neighbor, you know, I'm going to really get into it. It's not that kind, that's getting involved with it. Then you're already entangled. Then you're kind of for it. It's a kind of where you kind of settle back in a sense and make a very big open space for that experience. You're not for or against it. You don't act from it. You don't act against it. Just let it be there. Does that make sense? So these are two important qualities, recognizing what's happening in the present and then allowing for having it be there. Learning to be in the present moment and recognizing what's going on, being present for experience, is also no small task. In principle, it's very easy, right? All of you, to some degree, are present for me as I'm talking. It seems like most of you are attentive. And have your attention. You're mindful. You're attentive. You're here as I'm talking. You're here in the present moment. Thank you. It's very nice. So we have that ability. But we're taking some ability which is somewhat innate or natural to all of us, and we're going to train it. We're going to develop it, kind of like it's a muscle. So it becomes a kind of strength that's always available for us. So it's not something that you don't only bring attention to that which interests you, but you're always ready. You're always there to be present for experience. So you seem mostly present to me as I'm talking. I'm not sure why, but you are. But we'll see in a short while, when it's time for us to meditate, close your eyes and sit still and be present for your experience, how well you do then. You'll probably find that your inner life in the present moment as it's unfolding is not as compelling as I am. In the present moment. Or you'll find that not being present is more compelling. You'll find that suddenly you drift off into future thinking or planning the future or remembering a conversation in the past or some experience in the past, or you wander into fantasy. So all these places you go with the mind. I mean, you can certainly do that while I'm talking. I mean, some of you probably will do it at times when I get boring up here. Then the mind kind of, goes off. So this ability to, so what happens is that over a lifetime, many of us have actually trained the mind to very easily fall into the grooves that take us away from the present moment. And you see how powerful that is if you sit down and intentionally try to stay in the present moment, moment by moment. So you'll see that in a little while. So we're training and cultivating this very simple thing. So it's not something mystical and bizarre that comes from Asia. It's something that's very common to all of us, attention, awareness. And we're kind of claiming it for ourselves. We're developing our ability to master it, to use it, to be on top of it, to be able to stay with it, as opposed to our attention being hijacked by our fantasies and desires and hates and, you know, all the different ways the mind can kind of wander off. Now, the mind, because it is relatively fickle and is so quick to be able to wander off away from the present moment, one of the techniques that we use to help train the mind to be in the present moment is to train the mind to be with the breath. If you're with your breathing, you're always with something happening in the present moment. The breath is a relatively simple experience. For most people, it's a neutral experience. And it has a kind of rhythm to it, kind of rises and passes and rises and passes. And because of the rhythm, the rising and passing, and because it's in the present moment, it turns out that it's, and for other reasons, it's a very good place to begin training the mind to be in the present moment. What you'll find out is, again, as I said, how difficult it is to keep the mind on the breath. So then you can do two things. You could get discouraged and give up, which I hope you don't do. Or you can have the following understanding, that what you're doing when you're staying with the breath and you find it's difficult to be with your breath, you're learning about the power and momentum of your mind. You're learning your mind is out of control. You're learning how speedy the mind is, how quick it is to take up your thoughts and fantasies and thinking about the past and the future, and how quick it is to be reactive and judgmental. And that'll be highlighted because you're trying to stay with the breath. If you don't try to stay with the breath, then you might... I'll use an analogy. If you take a very quiet mountain stream, very shallow mountain stream, that's very pure, clear water, and you can look down at it, and you might not tell the water is flowing. Until you put a stick in the water, up, sticking straight down, and then you see that, yes, there's a little waves created as the river washes by that stick. So you need a reference point to see the movement of the river. The same thing is true with our minds and our hearts, our emotions. It's very helpful to have a reference point, some stake you put down in the middle of the flow of your present moment experience, in order to be able to see how fast the mind is moving. And so the breath functions that way. So the breath is both a good place to develop concentration and mindfulness, to strengthen that muscle, and it's a good place to begin seeing what really makes us tick, what's really going on for us. And we say in Buddhism that it's better to know that your mind is out of control than to have a mind that's out of control and not know it. You follow that? So when we get ready to start being with the breath in the meditation, don't be discouraged by how it is. The practice works either if you stay with your breath, or if not being able to stay with breath very well, you really clearly see what's going on otherwise. So it works either way, right? So it's very forgiving and very, very accepting of you. So we'll start with the breath. And it's kind of like the center of gravity for this meditation that we do. And then we'll continue over the weeks. At the beginning of each class, I'll take 5 or 10 minutes to see if there's any questions that any of you might have from the previous week or from having done the practice at home. And I hope you try the practice at home, because it's only by applying yourself to the instructions that you'll really learn what the instructions are. You'll have questions about it. You'll find out maybe what's confusing or what doesn't work. And you'll come back hopefully the following week with some concerns, some questions, some reports about how it went in trying to apply it at home. So the hope is that each of you, in the course of this 5 weeks, starts a daily meditation practice. And the daily meditation practice, I hope, would be, if you're brand new to meditation, you might start with 15 minutes. And then the following week, add 5 minutes. There's 20 minutes. And the following week, add 5 minutes. You have 25 minutes. And if you feel like it, add one more set of 5 minutes. So by the end, you're doing maybe 30 minutes. And see what that's like. So in the beginning, 15 minutes a day. So I'm kind of just giving introduction to all of this. And as a part of the introduction, Allison tapes these talks. So some people, for some reason, can't come to one of the classes, and they'd like to hear what I said. And so Allison makes these available to people, the tapes. So you can talk to her if you know you're going to miss one or you want a copy of this for some reason. The other thing is that the way that our center offers all of the teaching that goes on here, all the opportunities, activities that goes on here, is on a donation basis. And so that's the basis, you know, of how this class is being offered. And the system we have is we have two baskets out by the door. And one basket says, I think, operations. It uses the word dana. Dana is a Buddhist word for donations. Operations dana. And the other basket has the sign that says teacher dana. And it'd be very nice if people made donations in each both baskets. It's what makes all this whole thing work. And how much you want to put in there is really up to you. For the intro class, I usually have a suggested amount. But it still just leaves it up to you. It's just a suggested amount. And the suggested amount is that in the operations basket, you put maybe $2 or $3. And in the teacher dana, the teacher basket, the suggestion is $10 per class. And so it's a little bit unusual. So this is my livelihood. I'm a teacher, meditation teacher. And my whole livelihood comes from people's making donations. It's kind of a remarkable thing in our society. And something that I think is quite beautiful. But that's something for another time to talk about. So any questions about logistics or about the course so far? Anything I've said so far you'd like to ask? As I go along here, you're welcome to interrupt me anytime, except during the meditations. Oh, yes, please.
Do you offer the intro class any other days of the week?
I don't now. I think that in maybe May or something, May and June, I'm going to offer it on Tuesday evenings. So that's, you know, the plan then. And I have it in the back of my mind to someday offer it during weekday days. How many of you would have preferred having it during weekday days rather than an evening? So very few. So maybe there's, well, those people who can't come in the evenings wouldn't have been here anyway to raise their hand. there's also occasionally an interclass kind of like this offered in San Jose. And that's, I think that's also Wednesday evenings. Yes?
Do you recommend any position?
Yeah, I'll talk about posture in just a few minutes. Oh, yeah. We have sittings and classes here Thursday evening. And it's a little bit more oriented towards beginners. And at 6:30? At 6:30? Before that 7:30 class, at 6:30 there's a one-time introduction to the meditation. So it doesn't lay it out, you know, as carefully as I'll do in this class. But if you want to go for, you can go there. And you can even go a couple of times and ask questions and stuff like that.
Suggested readings.
Oh, there's lots of
homework.
Everything you need to learn, you can learn through your own powers of observation if you really use it. So that's what I encourage you to do. If you want to read something, there's all kinds of really good basic introductory books into mindfulness practice. And you can go to any bookstore and they'll have books, you know, in mindfulness practice. Or we have a library here. You can look at some of the books there. I think there's actually a shelf on introductory books or meditation books or something?
Yeah, for beginners level, there's a little read class on.
So mindfulness being the being present for your experience, is recognizing as clearly as you can, and then finding some way, the equanimity or the non-reactivity, just allow it to be. At least long enough until you have a wiser response on how to be with it. And I want to give another analogy for kind of this before we do the first meditation. If you're in a really tight elevator, small elevator with, you know, really tight, it's meant for two people and there's four of you in the elevator, you might feel kind of claustrophobic and kind of, you know, kind of feel like your personal space is invaded. But if you have the same four people in Grace Cathedral, some huge cathedral, you know, the opposite sides of the, you know, this huge room, you know, it's easy to love all beings then, you know, I love you, you know, far away, you know. It's, you know, you have it's all this space, and you don't feel oppressed by those people because of all that space. Our minds are kind of like, oftentimes, are like the crowded elevator. And we're so riding our thoughts, our concerns, our obsessions, our preoccupations, our everything so closely, so tightly, that there's very little space in there, and it can feel very oppressive. And part of the movement of meditation is bringing presence to the experience, allowing it to be there, not interfering with it. Can be likened to creating space in the mind, creating space in the awareness, creating space in the body or space in the heart, making lots of space so that an experience that before was oppressive or difficult becomes much more manageable and you can actually be quite at ease with what's there. And one of the ways to do this is to be with the breath. So before we do that, I'd like to talk now about meditation posture. And I think it's very helpful to give some focus to having an aligned posture. There's various benefits that come from that. One is that it's easier to sit for longer periods of time without the body being uncomfortable if your body's basically upright and aligned. If you're hunched over in some way, it actually, you know, it puts a strain on the back and strain on different parts of your body. If you just kind of lean casually against a chair, like you can do sofa meditation, it's not very conducive, very helpful for developing a certain kind of alertness. We want to be alert. And some people think meditation is all about relaxing, so sitting in a soft couch is perfect. I was in a 3-month retreat once, which is a long time to meditate. And after about, I don't know how long, 6-7 weeks of doing this, my body was aching a little bit, and I said, you know, maybe I should give my body a little bit of a break. I'll go take one session of meditation that day and do it in the couch, the soft couch in the library there. And I sat down on the couch, and the next thing I knew, the meditation session was over. And I had fallen asleep. So I stopped sitting in the couch. It's easier for the body to relax in a very deep way if the body's aligned. If you're hunched over or slouching or leaning against a chair, the body actually can't relax as deeply as it can as when you're sitting upright and really letting gravity operate on straightening out and lining up the body. And sitting up straight kind of keeps the chest somewhat open, which helps the breathing. It helps us relax the belly properly. Having a good aligned posture is really helpful in many ways. So now you can sit either on the floor or on a chair. The classic, you know, idea is meditators sit cross-legged on the floor. And there's some benefits to sitting on the floor. One of the benefits is that it lowers your center of gravity. And so if your center of gravity is lower, you feel more stable. And it's easier to relax deeply if you have this low center of gravity. By sitting cross-legged, you form a nice tripod with your knees and your butt. And that tripod makes you relatively stable. Again, the more stable base you have, the easier it is to let go and just, you know, be here in a relaxed way. If you sit in a chair, you tend not to have the same stability as being on the floor, but you can get close to it. And the chair is a fine place to sit. But first, I'll talk a little bit about sitting on the floor and some of you might want to try it at home and experiment. I think it's well worth, you know, experimenting and trying to find that ability. I recommend that people sit not cross-legged, but sit on the floor with one leg in front of the other, kind of like this. So not cross-legged like this, but one leg in front of the other, Taylor fashion or Burmese fashion. And that puts the least amount of torque on the knees. And so it makes it easier. And also on the ankles, kind of twist, tends to twist it the least. And also, it's more or less symmetrical. If you start sitting quarter lotus, which is having your foot up on your calf, half lotus, which is your foot up on your thigh, it tends to tilt the body to one side. Most people then will ride it up, but then you're stretching one side of your body more than the other. And a good yoga teacher will tell you, never do that. Always stretch both sides equally. But it's more or less symmetrical, you know, by sitting this way. And then the recommendation is that you sit up on a cushion or a pillow. Sitting on these round cushions is quite good. Some people like to sit on half moon cushions. Allison has one there, and they find that more stable. And you want to experiment with how high you sit. If your hips are really open, then you might want to sit really low. If your hips are really tight, you want to sit really high. Maybe get two of these on top of each other. And what you want to try to do is to sit in such a way that up here, so your pelvis is tipped forward slightly, making it easier then for your knees to drop down, and your knees are actually on the mat or on the floor. And sometimes sitting higher, you can do that if you're tight. If you can't get your knees down, then what you can do, if you want to sit this way, you can, is you can sit this way with your knees up, dangling, and then put a blanket or a pillow underneath your pillow, underneath your knees, so they have support. And when you sit cross-legged this way, or with your feet this way, you can actually experiment also with different positions for your feet, where your knees are closer together to each other, or your knees are farther apart, or your ankles and your heels are closer to your body, or your heels, you know, legs are further away like this. Experiment with different ways. Sometimes for new people, for the first couple few weeks or something, the legs will fall asleep. And sometimes by having small adjustments, it can make a big difference in whether the feet fall asleep or not. There's also a sitting on your knees, and you can take one of these round pillows, put it upright like this, put it between your ankles, and then sit down like this. And this is a fine way of sitting too. It's not as stable, but some people like to sit this way. And there's also benches that some people have and that like that you sit on the bench sitting this way, and that's quite comfortable too. Allison also sells these things. So there's various places you can get them, like East West Books has them, and probably other places. Country Sun, maybe in Palo Alto, used to have them. And also Allison, you can order them through Allison if you'd like to get this kind of meditation paraphernalia. And the internet has them too. You can order them through the internet. There's probably a lot of places on the internet, mail, you know, catalog places, where you can buy these kinds of zafus and cushions. And now, if you're sitting on a chair, one of the most important things on a chair is to make sure that your knees are not higher than your hips, because if they are, then you tend to sit with your back, lower back, kind of bent out, which puts a strain. Long term, that's quite bad. And so, if your hips are a little bit, your knees are a little bit lower than your hips or equal to the height, it's a little bit better for your lower back. Also, if you're sitting on a chair, it's best, if you can, not to use the backrest. What's the point then? but to sit away from the backrest. Some people have to use a backrest, and it's fine to do that. But you really want to be able to be self-reliant, support yourself. And the more you can support yourself, the more actually, more deeply you can relax. You think you can relax more deeply if you're leaning against a chair, but actually you relax more deeply if you're sitting upright. And also you have the right balance that way between a certain kind of alertness and relaxation at the same time. Because you don't want to be completely relaxed in all ways. Then you just be a puddle. You want to be just, there's a nice kind of interplay between relaxation and, I don't know what the right word is, tautness or alertness in meditation. And if you need to use a backrest, then the preference would be that you have support in your lower back rather than your whole length of the back. But if you have to use the whole length of the back, that's fine to do that. You don't want to cross your legs when you're sitting meditating on a chair. The classic position is to have your legs straight out parallel to each other with both feet firmly on the floor. Though some people like to have their legs out wide like this when they're sitting in the chair, and that gives them a nice strong support, feeling a broad support that helps. Once you have the base set, you want to make sure your spine is aligned. And one way, little trick you can do is you can take your hands on either side of your hips. And for most people, I think you can do this in the chair too. And lift yourself almost off your seat. Let your chest come up. And then as you release your arms, let your shoulders roll back. And you might have a feeling of the shoulders hanging a little bit. And your spine is straighter than maybe normally would. And then let your stomach relax. Soften your belly. What you don't want to do is lean forward, so your center, so your gravity, your center of gravity, is projected in front of you. You don't want to be leaning back. You want to see if you can get your weight, in a sense, travel right through the midpoint of your lower back. It's like a pivot there. Let your weight kind of let that take most of the weight. We generally sit. With the hands, you can do anything with your hands where both hands are doing the same thing, kind of symmetrical. You can have your hands on your thighs, on your knees, up or down. The classic Buddhist way of meditating is actually to have your hands together. One hand, the left hand usually, on top of the right, in the palm of the right, with the thumbs touching. Some people just have them together like this, kind of casually. Anything is fine. However, if you're sitting the way I suggested, depending on your, I guess, proportions of your body. Some people find that having their hands too far forward like this or down here on their ankles pulls their shoulders forward and creates a strain in the back here. And so then what you want to do is get some kind of like a pillow or sweater or something and put it on here so that your hands are held higher, pull them back this way, not to put the strain there. In some traditions, they insist that you should have your hands being kind of floating. So not resting on anything, floating kind of in front of your belly button. It's stressed that your head should be balanced on your shoulders. Seems silly to say that, but in fact, people often will have their head sticking forward, sometimes their chin sticking up, sometimes leaning a little bit this way or turning this way a little bit. And you want to kind of, you know, maybe rotate your neck and head a little bit and get it kind of well aligned on your torso. And the classic suggestion is you tip your chin down and back when you meditate. And I recommend that you can get the same thing through a different movement, and that is to create a little bit of openness, space, between the last vertebrae and your skull. I think that is actually, it's a little bit more relaxing to do that way than to pull your chin in. We meditate, our general recommendation is that people meditate with their eyes closed. It's not a hard and fast rule, but that's the usual recommendation, and which means just kind of gently close the eyes, having them look at nothing. And it's also recommended that you have your tongue resting against the roof of your mouth, because it said that controls the wandering, thinking mind. So you'll do that, and you won't believe it. So those are the basic points of posture. Any point, maybe if you come early one day, I can be a little bit early, and if you have particular questions about your own posture, I can look at it and talk to you about it. But any general questions about posture, meditation posture?
So what do the hands symbolize in the posture?
I don't know if it needs to symbolize anything. In this particular tradition, coming from Southeast Asia, it tends for the most part not to be very symbolic oriented. It tends to be very kind of down to earth, and things are as they are, and you know. And whereas in the Buddhism of Mahayana Buddhism of Tibet and China and Japan, they use symbolism not just symbolically, but as very powerful representatives of or channels for for better or lack of for lack of a better expression, for spiritual energies. And this mudra, this is called a mudra. Any gesture of the hand is called a mudra. And this one here is sometimes called the cosmic mudra. It's like you're holding the whole universe in your, you know, like the shape of an egg in your hand. More than that. Also, it's said that I've heard, I don't know if this is just, you know, folk tales or whether it has, I don't know what else it would be, but there's some idea that I've heard that we put our left hand on top of the right because, one hand symbolizes compassion and the other symbolizes wisdom. And and most people need one more than the other. So that's why you put the left over the right. But I forget now which one is compassion and which one is wisdom. So I don't know which, you know. I just know this is the right way to do it. So. I think it's fine in the short term. I think over the long term, like if you're meditating for, you know, on retreat or something, doing a lot of meditation, it probably put a strain on your body that feels uncomfortable, the push and the tension. And just looking at how you're sitting now, I can't see that well. But my guess is that you can probably get the same effect that you're trying to get by sitting higher. So you might...
Raised up,
yeah. We don't. I mean, it's a kind of a Ashtanga yoga thing, right? Where you kind of your band, what's it called? Your mula bandha, which is kind of like the. We tend not to do anything extra. We tend to leave. Part of what we're trying to do here, there's all kinds of yogic things a person can do in meditation, and certainly like sitting full lotus is a very powerful yogic posture to take. It has physiological benefits to sit full lotus for meditation. It helps create concentration and all that. But what we're trying to do in mindfulness practice is basically take a comfortable upright posture that's kind of a normal posture, not too bizarre, not doing anything special, and then learning to purify or deal with our life as it actually appears to us without doing anything extra, without trying to make something happen, without trying to use some extra kind of thing to give, you know, particular strong strength or strength of concentration. Because what happens, many of us are often searching for something that's going to do it for us, something that's going to, you know, be the solution. And it's actually to actually stop trying to do anything is the most difficult thing we have. And in a sense, we use simplicity and the lack of forms, the lack of technique as our teacher in this tradition here. And we have very little forms, as some traditions have. Very little. Some people. I would like to say that the practice I'm going to teach you is not a technique at all. And so, so you're just left with your own devices. You're left with yourself. And it's one of the most challenging things to do is to learn to purify, refine, work with, become free of, become present for your life as it actually is, rather than doing some little thing, even if it's very little, to try to, you know. But I told you to put your tongue against the roof of your mouth. So, you know, it's already something. I've already polluted you. So I think what happens in as meditation gets deeper and deeper, something like that, probably something like that, like tightening your mula bandha, is probably something that takes too much effort. It takes too much attention. You have to keep part of your mind operating to keep it going, unless it becomes second nature, or so it becomes kind of automatic or something. And sure.
The stability that you're talking about, you can like get real set.
Sure, sure. You're welcome to do it. So, are you ready to try? You've been sitting for a while. It might be good if you stood a little bit and kind of refreshed your legs and stretched. Everybody's hearing okay? The speaker's working okay? Everybody's hears? Okay. So, spend a few minutes now getting yourself established in meditation posture. And it's a mindfulness exercise in and of itself to spend some time being careful about the posture you take. And I've noticed when I was a Zen student that one of the ways to tell the difference between a new Zen student and an old Zen student, someone who had been a Zen student for a long time, was the longer a person had been a Zen student, the more time they took getting into their posture, settling, and they would kind of move their body left and right, and kind of wiggle a little bit, and kind of move forward and back, and just kind of just lining everything up just right. Whereas someone who's new would just sit down. And so take a little bit of time getting into your posture. The way I often express it is take an alert but relaxed posture. Alert, comfortable posture. And then gently close your eyes. It's helpful in the first couple of minutes of a meditation session to do a couple of setting up exercises or entry exercises. Little exercises that help you kind of get into the present moment more fully. And these are very simple things. One of them is to take a couple of minutes, a minute or however long you want, to take some long, slow, deep breaths. And as you breathe in deeply, to use that in-breath as a way of connecting to your body, reminding yourself to be here. And as you exhale, to relax, to let your body let go of any tensions that might be there. Breathing in deeply, filling as much of your body as you can with the breath or with the expansion of the breathing. And as you exhale, relax your shoulders, your belly. And using this deep breath as a reminder that what you're going to do for this period of meditation is to train the mind to be here and now. Or to say it a different way, you're going to train the mind to be in the same place as the body. The mind and body to be in the same place at the same time. If you're sitting here and thinking about what happened at work today or yesterday or something, then your mind is in a different time and place than your body. Your body's here and now. So we want to harmonize, get the body and the mind together. It's really precious to have the two of them in the same place at the same time together. Taking these deep breaths is a reminder to do this. And after doing this for a minute or so, then you can let your breath return to normal. Just relax. And another kind of part of setting up exercise is to take a minute or so to scan your body, maybe starting at the top, and slowly going through your body and seeing if there's any obvious places where you can relax the muscles or soften them a little bit. Maybe the forehead and the eyes. The jaws. The shoulders. Even a little bit of softening of the shoulders can be helpful. It's Some people can relax the chest. The arms and the hands. And then particularly useful is to relax the belly, to soften the abdomen, to let it hang forward in a way that popular culture is considered unbecoming. If you have tight pants on, it can be helpful to loosen them, loosen the belts. So first taking a few deep breaths, then going through your body, relaxing anything that you can. And then taking a few moments to feel your body in its entirety. Kind of a global panoramic, just a sense of being present in your body. And then within your body, as part of your body, to become aware of your breathing. Become aware of how your body experiences the breathing. If you have trouble feeling your breathing, you can put your hand on your belly or your chest and feel the rising and falling, the movement there. Some people feel the breathing more in their stomach, rising and falling, or feel the breathing process more in their chest, expanding and contracting. Some people feel it more in their nostrils as the air goes in and out. Some people feel it more globally, the global sense of the body expanding and contracting. All these ways are fine. The idea is to connect with your breathing. And then once you've found your breathing, to sustain the attention with the breath, to hang out with it, hang in there with it, breathing in and breathing out. When you notice that your mind gets lost in thought or is preoccupied with your thinking, then very gently let go of your thinking, acknowledge what's happening and let go of the thinking, and begin again with your breathing. Feeling the breath again, getting to know it, sensing it. The breathing can be very helpful to help us relax and to help us get more concentrated. If we're present for the breath, we don't get much benefit this way from the breathing if we're not present for it. But if we're present for it, lots of benefits can come. Breathing in, breathing out. Some people find it helpful to label the breathing as a way of helping them stay present for the breath. It's kind of like using a thought to stay present, rather than letting your thinking mind be idle and wander off in thought. And the label can be as simple as just saying in for the in-breath and out for the out-breath, or rising as the belly or chest rises and falling as it falls. Very quiet, subtle little whisper, nudging the mind to stay present, to be with the experience of breathing. It doesn't matter how many times your mind wanders away. Just like when you notice that's happening, to softly recognize it and begin again. As soon as you recognize you're lost in thought, begin again with the breathing. If you feel a need to be more relaxed, it can be helpful to emphasize the exhale, kind of, not to exhale more harder, but just to kind of rest or let go as you exhale. It's a natural letting go there. If you find yourself tired, it might be helpful just to have a little more attention to the in-breath. Let the upwelling, the arising, the energizing aspects of in-breath fill your body and mind, make you more alert. Hang in there with the breath. Hang in with the rhythm of your breathing. Letting go of everything else. Just breathing in and breathing out as if it's the most important thing to do at this moment. If you find it difficult to be with the breathing, then acknowledge what it is that makes it difficult. See that clearly. See it clearly. Don't interfere with it in the sense of being for or against it. Maybe once it's more clearly acknowledged, it's easier, in a sense, to put it aside and then come back to the breathing. Breathing in and breathing out. So if you do this every day, or say back up and say it this way, some people find there's a very strong tendency to try to measure their experience, to judge how it's going. They'll sit down and they'll breathe to meditate and do four or five breaths and then ask themselves, how am I doing? Have I arrived yet? You know, is it some place to go? And it's best not to have any real concerns with how you're doing while you're meditating. Measure how you're doing or compare yourself with ideas or other meditations. And just in a very simple, ordinary way, just do the practice day after day. And some of the benefits and some of the changes that will come with the practice are not going to be obvious in the moment. You're not going to see the moment of change. Oh, now my concentration's really kicked in. You might occasionally see that, but what you're more likely to see is slow, gradual development of this capacity of the mind to be present and mindful. But it takes the regular practice every day. It's kind of like, say, you know, you want to, you know, run a marathon. So training is a good idea, right? So you decide you go get out, and first you get, you know, the perfect shoes and the perfect jogging outfit, and then you have to rest for a few months, you know. And then you finally manage to get out there, you know, on the track. And say you do a good run for one day. And it's pretty good. So that was really good training. And then you don't go back out to run again for 6 months. You know, you're not getting the benefits of kind of being of conditioning yourself, of, you know, that happens when you do every day, a kind of regular practice. So same thing with meditation. There's a lot of benefits that come from the regularity of doing it. So Does anyone have any questions or comments or reports about what that was like, the little session? That's a good question. If the mind has got getting dull or seems like cloudy, seems like there's a cloud or film between your awareness and what you're aware of, or if the mind is gets complacent, kind of just drifting kind of on the surface of things or drifting away into its thoughts, then it's probably not a very helpful state to be in. With mindfulness meditation, it's not so much the idea of getting into a meditative state that's important. What's important is developing our capacity to be present for what's actually here. And sometimes there's very powerful meditative experiences that can happen. And then people kind of check out with those experiences. Rather than continuing to train themselves to be present with those experiences and to allow them to be, to recognize them and allow them to be. In the beginning, it can be very, very, very skillful to do that. And then I think probably after some days or some weeks or some point, you probably start getting a hang of how to really connect to the breath directly. You don't need to have your hands in there anymore. And when I'm with my breath, when I feel my breath in my stomach or my chest, I feel like it's almost like I'm being massaged from the inside. So rather than hands on the outside, it's more like I have hands on the inside that are kind of expanding and pushing. And there's pressure and movement from the inside going out. Coming from in, going out. And it's very, lovely. Yes?
I have a question about that comes up to me frequently, which is I get like an itch or something, and then I'm not sure whether I'm supposed to just itch it. I notice that if I wait for a while, it goes away, but I'm like intensely focused on it until it does.
The best recommendation with an itch is just if you're cultivating mindfulness of the breathing, just ignore the itch, and if the itch is really intense, try to match the compelling intensity of the itch with a strength of resolve on the breath. I'm not going to give in to this itch. I'm going to stay. And, it's kind of like the rodeo. It's like you really kind of tough it out. And sometimes meditation is that. You have to really kind of, if what you're trying to do is develop that concentration in the breath, you have to, that's kind of, you kind of do that. As the instructions proceed in this course, you'll learn, like next week, that we don't just do breath, but we also bring our attention to the body sensations when they're that compelling. And so then you do meditation on itching. You don't scratch, you don't itch. But you really let that be the place you develop your concentration. And probably your mind won't waver that much. It's very compelling. It's like, it's a great place to cultivate, And one of the great, probably the unspoken meditation subjects in Southeast Asia among many monastics, monks and nuns, and has been mosquito meditation. And first you're sitting there, minding your own business, watching your breath. And you hear the sound, and then you hear it. And you do, so you're listening meditation for a while. You hear, you're really present for that sound, and then you're really present for the little sensation, his little feet kind of walking around on your cheek. I've done this, right? And then at some point you don't feel anything. You know what that's about. And then after a little while you'll feel the itch, and then the itch is very compelling for a while. And so you're there doing itch meditation for a while. And then at some point you hear, and off it goes. It's gorged. It's happy. And by the time it leaves, before it happens, your mind's kind of wandering around. You're thinking about this and that and trying to be present. And by the time the mosquito leaves, you're really present. an itch, like it's not a mosquito here, I hope, but an itch, is safe. I don't know anybody who's died from an itch. So it's a relatively safe place to kind of just, you know, see what it takes. Develop that strength that it takes to be with it. And if you're really drowning in the itch, then of course you can welcome to scratch. Now, one of the interesting phenomena around meditation is that there's a number of unusual things that can happen when the mind starts getting really concentrated or deeply calm. And one of the things that happens to some people, don't expect this to happen to any of you, but it happens to some people, is that as the mind gets concentrated and calm, is that it starts feeling as if there's strange sensations on the surface of your skin. And some sensations can be like tingling in your hands, or warmth in your hands, or coolness, or a feeling of pulsing someplace in your body. But sometimes you can feel like your body suddenly gets, it's changing shape. Like you feel like something like your neck is really long, or your body's really long, and you're about to touch the ceiling. Or sometimes you feel like you're something that gets really squat. Your perception kind of, but your body kind of change. But one of the things that can happen is that your body can start itching a lot. Your skin can start itching a lot. And some people describe it as if ants crawling all over their skin. Or as if their skin is crawling across their body, kind of just crawling. And I remember that happened to me sometimes, and I'd be sitting there in Southeast Asia where they had a lot of ants. And I was convinced, oh, there's an ant. There's an ant. I know there's an ant. And so finally I opened my eyes. There's nothing there. And it's just a kind of phenomena of a concentrated mind. It's a phase that some people go through. So if what you're feeling comes with getting calmer and more concentrated, then you should just be patient with it and just know that it's a phase and you'll go deeper with time. But sometimes itches are just itches, right? They're just there. Is that helpful?
Or yeah.
Is it okay? Is it discouraging?
No, it's what I
what you do. Good. Are there questions? Yes, please.
When I close my eyes, it's not all black. I can still see colors. Should I try not to focus on that, or is that just part of being with myself?
For right now, for this first week, just be with the breath. Let go of that. Just turn attention away from that and be with the breath. Some people have quite strong visual field and their eyes closed. And we maybe talk about that a little bit later. Generally, what we do is that can be a subject of mindfulness too. Just see that. The problem with the visual field of colors is that some people get interested in it, and interest is not the same thing as mindfulness. That you're kind of leaning into it as opposed to just it's there. Yes. Great question. I think it's best, especially for beginners, to have some way of timing your meditation session so that you can just be at rest about how long you're sitting and not be kind of looking. Because some people will look, a minute can seem like, intolerable length of time sometimes. It's like, so various reasons. It's just going to put it out of your mind. You don't think about the time anymore. And just have a timer. And there's all kinds of timers you can get. There's a wide variety of things you can do that, makes a pleasant sound after 20 minutes or 15 minutes or however long you sit. Allison is putting together she's taping silence. And then at the end of various, I guess there's different tracks in her CD. And you can do, either there's a 15-minute track and the 20-minute track and the whatever. And so if you want to sit for 20 minutes, you push the button for a 20-minute track, and then you don't know whether your stereo is working or not because nothing happens. You just have to trust. And but you play, and you sit there. After 20 minutes, there's a nice bell. Bing. So, which is very nice. Yeah. So there's other play things. So there's all kinds of creative ways of keeping time, but I recommend it. I also recommend this, you can think about it. You don't have to do it this way, but I recommend it, is that it's helpful to have an element of commitment with a meditation practice where you commit yourself to sit every day, more or less at the same time, if it works for your life to do that, and for a particular length of time. So that by having a commitment like that, you're putting it outside of your preferences, your likes and dislikes, what you feel like doing. Because some people will only meditate when they feel good. And there's other camp, which only meditate when they feel bad. And in order to kind of feel better or something. And what we're trying to do is to let our whole life be processed through the field of awareness, of meditation. And learn how to be present for our life without preferences. Just this, be present. Develop presence without preferences. And so one way of learning to do that is to have this commitment. I'm going to sit regardless of whether I want to or not. Which is kind of counterintuitive and it goes against the grain of popular culture. But I'm going to do this. I'm going to do it regardless of my preferences. You know, short of common sense, you know, if the house is burning down. Then. But that's something I also recommend, is doing that. It's also helpful if you have a place in your house, your home, that is kind of designated as your meditation place, like a little corner of your bedroom or something, so that all the associations in that place are about meditation. So when you go there, it's kind of a simple place, and you don't, that doesn't elicit other thoughts, associations, just this is what you do. Most people find classically that it's useful to meditate first thing in the morning or relatively early in the morning, before their mind gets too busy and before the activities of the day have started taking over and before the phone calls start coming in. And but some people are kind of, you know, evening people and they prefer to meditate in the evening. You know, different people have different ways of meditating. But if you don't know what kind of person you are, then start by the morning. Try that out. Yes, please. Between awareness and what you're aware of. How's your eyesight? Pretty good. You have some awareness of how good your eyes are, how well they function. And then you can look around the room and see different things, right? So there's the seeing and there's what you see. They're two different things. So there's the awareness of something and then there's what you're aware of. So some people like to distinguish between those two things, and so many of us have an experience. Something happens to us, and we don't really know. We don't really recognize. We're not really present for it, because we haven't turned our attention there. Like some people will talk without much awareness, right? And only afterwards, oh, why did I say that? But you can talk and know that you're talking. You can think and know you're thinking. You can think and not know you're thinking. And you can think and know you're thinking. So that ability to know is what we're developing here, the capacity to see clearly, be present for what's going on. And it's different than what's happening. It's kind of like a spotlight that we can shine clearly on experience. The ability to be present for the ability to be present for something is really what one of the things we're developing. And it's so helpful. You know how it is, you know, with friends, or you know, if you're feeling really bad, or it's really nice to have a friend you can talk to who you feel is really present for you. You really feel the sense of presence. And you can feel a different quality in some people's how much they're really present for you when they're with you. And you really feel kind of, it's really nice to be present, have such a sense of presence. Someone's really connected, they're there for you, and they're not too far into you, they're not, you know, on top of you, but they're not kind of receding or, you know, hesitant about being there. They're really present in a firm way, complete way. Well, that same sense of presence we can bring to ourselves. We can bring to our breath, we can bring to our body, we can bring to our present moment experience. And that's a capacity that we can train and develop so we can go through our life with a greater presence rather than the opposite, which tends to be distraction. People are often so distracted from the distractions, they don't even know they're distracted. So, other questions?
I would prefer morning, but in my house there's a lot of noise, and I do have a place to go, but the noise is there, and you just have, you know, pots and pans and dogs. And you just allow the noise?
You could. One of the many people associate meditation with silence and quiet and, you know, all these wonderful things. I've been to many meditation monasteries in Asia, especially in Southeast Asia, and finding a silent meditation monastery is almost impossible. Either the monastery is noisy or there's a village nearby. And in villages in Thailand and Burma, they love these loudspeakers. And they're always these scratchy sounds, these scratchy, poor quality loudspeakers, and they're blaring away. You're trying to meditate, and I mean, there's a song by Madonna. I don't know the title of it, but you know, Just Like a Virgin, something, right? Well, luckily they sang it in Burmese, so I didn't have to listen to the lyrics. But I probably heard it, you know, more than all of you combined. You know, over and over again, night and day, middle of the night, 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, they're blasting away, and you know, and then so that was the local village. But then there's a local neighboring monastery, which decided that it's very it creates kind of protective energy for the community if they recite, chant Buddhist scriptures out loud. And so there's an old tradition of doing that, and it's even better if you do it over the loudspeaker. And then they had this like Buddhist festival that lasted for 7 days, and they took 24 hours a day for 7 days in the neighboring monastery. They had this poor quality loudspeaker was blasting away in some language that I couldn't understand. You know, and then one monastery that in Bangkok, where the very serious meditation monastery and very people are very intent in their meditation, but the meditation hall was also the lobby of this very large monastery. And there was someone at the desk there on the telephone, and the telephone would be ringing, and people coming in and running in and out and going up the steps, and there's all this hustle and bustle, and there on the side, you know, was just people sitting and meditating. So meditation can be done with any conditions at all. And so you can do it with the pots and pans going. Initially, it might be difficult, and you might get easily distracted. But over time, you might find that you're actually developing a strength and a capacity to let go of preoccupations, a strength of being able to stay present, that you wouldn't have developed if you only practiced under the most ideal conditions. Yes?
I kind of have a comment. I've been meditating for 9 months, and this was identified day retreat, and this was my first chance to do a beginner's class. But I guess when I first started, I hadn't really had any instruction. I read a few books, went to a few day-long, and I just wanted to emphasize something you said, which is just not to compare yourself and not to judge yourself. And you know, when I first started meditating, I could go for 4 minutes, and I would get so distracted, I would literally forget I was meditating, and my mind would be off somewhere else, and I would literally jump out of my seat, I've got to do this thing, and then a minute later, think, you know, what was I doing?
Yeah.
I was meditating, you know, and go back, you know, whatever, and then slowly, it increased over the last few months, and it's been, you know, I've been meditating now every day for maybe 9 months, and it's been 3, 4, 5 months since I hopped out of my chair without, you know, awareness of what I was doing. So, you know, it's even if you start small, if you just make that little commitment to yourself that I'm going to be present with myself for however long I can, and just, you know, be present with your increasing ability to do that, it really does.
Beautiful.
It does work.
Yeah, you see all kinds of wisdom came out of you there. It's very nice. So certainly the continuity, just keeping it up in small increments and slowly building, it really bears tremendous fruit over time. The other thing is it's helpful if you don't compare yourself or measure yourself or constantly judging yourself how it's going and how you're the worst meditator on the block or whatever. And just put those thoughts aside it's be easy to say don't do it, right? But that's not so hard. Not so easy necessarily to stop doing those things. But what I'd ask you to do is to don't believe those thoughts. You're welcome to have them, but don't take them so seriously. You know, you've been warned. You've been told. Everybody has these kinds of thoughts. And And the other thing is, it's really helpful if you're kind to yourself in this meditation practice. Mm-hmm. Be very forgiving and kind how you are. It's very embarrassing to discover how your mind works. And someone once said, it's very humbling. And it's that way for everyone. So, you know, don't use what you learn about yourself through the meditation to be another reason to be self-critical. You know, it's actually part of the purification process to really see this stuff and learn how to bring kindness and acceptance to it and to be with it in a simple way. And the last thing, based on what you said, is you're forewarned now that you might... It's very easy to sit there meditation and suddenly it dawns upon you that this is exactly the only time, and the time, that you have to defrost the refrigerator. And it's absolutely compelling. Or clean the garage or something. So be very careful about... The mind is very tricky. And the mind... In some ways, the mind sometimes doesn't want to be present. And it's going to put up all these tricks at times to try to prevent you from really being present. And because it's threatening to the mind. The ego, the neurotic ego that many of us carry around, thrives on not being seen. Thrives by us not being present. And so as we start becoming present, all these unhealthy tendencies we have will protest. And that's another reason why to have this gentle, loving commitment. Just hang in there regardless of the, you know, state of the garage. Well, we'll talk about the body next week, how to bring mindfulness to the body, how to include that. For now, I'd encourage you just to kind of be with the breath, just, you know, and just focus on the breath and develop your capacity to be there. And if you figure out what time of the day, you know, seems to work the best for you, maybe you switch your run and your meditation time, you know, meditate first or sit later, or I don't know, just try to adjust it so it works for you. Okay. So thank you for your presence, listening here. And I wish you well in your practice over the next week. And we'll meet next week and talk about our bodies.